Today's reading is on page 1005, and it's Hebrews 8. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with their fathers, on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
Emmy, thanks very much for reading. And can I add my welcome to Sam's? It's really good to have you with us this Sunday evening, and great to be able to consider these important things together before we have a time of questions. It was 30 years ago this weekend, you may have seen on the news, that Germany set the world alight when the Berlin Wall came down. That was the evening. The next one is my favorite picture of someone from that day. This guy, Stephen, was in Berlin, happened to have his saxophone with him, so jumped up onto the wall and started to play, which is a great thing to do. They still sell bits of the Berlin Wall on eBay. You can pick a piece up for about £8, and they even have experts who can be sure that it really is the Berlin Wall rather than from someone's garden in North London. But it was a great day. It was a day of freedom. It was a day that people hadn't dared hope for, and then very suddenly and bloodlessly, it just happened. People said at the time, the politicians, that this was the beginning of a new world order. But I was interested this weekend that Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, was less than triumphalist in her comments. She said, this weekend, freedom, democracy, equality, rule of law, human rights, they are anything but self-evident. They have to be revitalized and defended time and time again. One of the reasons I was struck by her caution was because I'm reading this book at the moment by Richard Dawkins. It's his latest. It's called Outgrowing God. And we're going through it chapter by chapter with a Christian response at our Wednesday lunchtime talks. He raises really important objections and questions of the Christian faith and the goodness of the gospel. Says that we don't need God in order to be good. This is Dawkins. Over the centuries, over the millennia, we humans have been getting nicer, gentler, less violent, less cruel. The change has nothing to do with genetic evolution and nothing to do with religion. Whatever is in the air has been moving in what we can broadly see as the same direction from century to century. And his point is that he thinks it's a good direction. Something in the air is a phrase that he keeps using in that chapter to mean, well, he admits he can't precisely pin it down, but whatever it is, human beings gradually shifting the good way. And I think that's quite an interesting perspective given the backdrop of the 20th century. More people certainly born into better comfort and more prosperity than ever before. And also, we had the two deadliest conflicts in history in the 20th century. We were remembering them just now. More people died violently in the 20th century than the previous 19 put together. To which Dawkins' reply is, well, it was a very long time ago now. We've come a long way in about 50 years. And in some ways we have. There's been great progress, not just economically or technologically, progress in human rights and equality issues. But have we really changed that much since what's really just our grandparents' day? I wonder if Professor Dawkins really believes that, as an evolutionary biologist who's used to marking change in terms of thousands, even millions of years over which you'd see the development. Well, I think the Bible is more realistic about the human problem, and it's a cliche many of you will have heard before, but the heart of the human problem, the problem of the human heart. And as well as being more realistic, the Bible is wildly more optimistic about the solution. God promises to sort the world out by sorting us out. Verse 10 of Hebrews 8. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. I will. I will, says God, as he makes promises all the way through this reading about what he will do. And just 1 week into yet another election campaign, we're weary, aren't we, of being over-promised. Can I trust God's promises of what he will? Well, let's just put this into context briefly. Last week we saw that Jesus was such a great high priest. 8 verse 1 reminds us that we need him in that role. And the first paragraph there, verses 2 to 5, they're very intense, you might have felt as Emmy was reading. They start to describe the detail of Jesus' work for us as our high priest. Most of that is unpacked in chapter 9 and the first half of chapter 10. So if you want to know about tents and offerings and copies and shadows, come back next week for chapters 9 and 10. For today, what the rest of chapter 8 does is it zooms out to focus on the really big picture of the relationship between God and humanity that is what all this detail in Hebrews is achieving. Now, if you've come tonight with a friend, thank you for coming. Your Christian friend will, I'm sure, be honest with you about how easily us Christians can be wearied in the faith. We become impatient, just distracted by other things, and God gets that. He's provided Hebrews as a reminder to us that Jesus is so much better than anything else that could grab our wandering attention. Jesus offers a better hope for humanity than anything else religion offers or education. Certainly a better hope that something in the air might make us gradually nicer. I hope if you're looking in on Christian things this evening, you'll just be able to catch a glimpse of how much of a good thing you could have going with Jesus and why he is so much better than everything else. First, let's look at the big picture then, and this is point one on the sheet if you want to follow along. The end of verse 10 is actually one of the headline statements that drives the whole Bible. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. God's really into relationship with people. Go right back to the beginning. He creates people. We watched a clip from the movie Prince of Egypt a few weeks ago. It's coming to the West End, actually, so check that out in January when it comes as a production. Moses leading God's people out of slavery. I will take you to be my people, says God, and I will be a God. And I love how it's described in the middle of verse 9 here in chapter 8. On the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. It's great, isn't it? So intimate. God takes them by the hand and leads his precious ones to a place of safety, like a parent with a child, like a husband with a wife is also the language used in the Old Testament. Verses 8 to 12 here, you see how they're indented. That's because they're a quote from the book of Jeremiah, and in the original quote, it's from Jeremiah 31. It says, I was their husband, declares the Lord. It's an amazing idea. The comedian Chris Rock says there's only two kinds of people in the world. You'll either end up single and lonely or married and bored. A little bit cynical, you might say, but in a sense, he's right. We will always be dissatisfied because the other half that all of our hearts were made for is God himself. The theologian Augustine, not as cool as Chris Rock, but maybe more profound, our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. We were made to know our Maker. And this language of covenant in this chapter expresses the deep level of commitment that God wants with us, like a marriage where you bind yourself to the other. If you find the Bible difficult to get or hard to live out or scary, you know, the word fear is used a few times in Hebrews. Some of the details are technical and alien. Well, be wonderfully encouraged as you remember what God's big agenda is. God wants to marry people, to marry you. Does that sound weird? Well, it means he wants to commit himself to you, that your destiny would be all wrapped up in him, that you could know him as you are fully known. Makes me think, it sounds a bit boring when we say to people that you should think about becoming a Christian. Rather, what we mean is, come to a wedding where you are part of the bride of God. He wants to hold you by the hand, bring you to a place of safety. Could you think of anything better than that? Well, yeah, actually, we can, can't we? We can think of lots of things that might be better. That's the problem. And this is us moving on to our second point. And I might be wrong, but I actually don't think I've ever heard a sermon from this Old Testament book of Jeremiah, the bit that's quoted in 8 to 12. And I think that's interesting because it's a Bible book that's over 55 chapters long. It might be to do with the fact that it's a fairly depressing read, that people don't dip into it so much. What you see there is the story of a devoted virgin bride who very quickly became a whore, unfaithful against her loving husband. This is the story of God and Israel. The wedding, if you like, had taken place in Exodus chapter 24 and verses 7 to 8. These verses are going to come up on the screen. This is from the book of Exodus. And Moses kind of acting as the person officiating at the wedding, if you like, in these words. Moses took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it onto the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Slightly messy way of sealing the deal, isn't it? Chucking all the blood at them. It's a bit like exchanging the rings at the end of the vows. And I have suggested to couples who are getting married that they might want to try this instead, just to cause a bit of a splash. So far, no one has wanted to go for the blood instead of the rings. Anyway, the point is, look at what they're saying there. We will be obedient. Of course, we promise. Well, if you know anything about their story up to that point, you might be skeptical. And sure enough, God's bride did not stay faithful, verse 9 of Hebrews 8 again, for they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declared the Lord. And they went on again and again chasing other lovers until Jeremiah's day, when finally the long-suffering husband sent them packing from the family home. What would you expect God to do? This next picture is a woman called Janet Street Porter. That may mean nothing to you. She's a columnist, a broadcaster, a journalist, and she now mainly is on daytime TV. So she's definitely gone middle-aged. She used to be kind of very much with it in the 60s. Part of the 60s revolution, and she wrote recently very honestly about her first marriage, which on her part was, she says, a staggering catalogue of infidelity. Her first fling was with an actor, another with her tailor, and a third with the unnamed son of a famous painter. The marriage ended in 1974 when her husband Tim caught her spending the weekend with her newest lover. He turned up at that lover's house and issued an ultimatum. Leave with me in the next 10 minutes and we'll never mention this again. Janet replied, 10 minutes. As she argued with Tim about the unfairness of the time limit, the clock ticked. And then when the deadline passed, Tim and his Porsche roared off into the distance forever. And I guess that some of us painfully know all about that kind of breakdown from our own families. She says it was a marriage that was doomed from the start. Well, this is a marriage that was doomed from the start. Doesn't 8 verse 7 sound like a very strong thing to say about an arrangement that God had put in place? Verse 7. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Why was the first covenant faulty? Can you really say that about something that God put in place? Verse 8. For he finds fault with them. See, any arrangement that hangs on the faithfulness of faulty human beings is inevitably a faulty arrangement. And let's be honest, we can see ourselves in their failure, can't we? We struggle to stay true to New Year's resolutions that we make with just ourselves. Never mind the ways we overpromise people, and that's before we even mention obligations we may have to Almighty God. Be suspicious of any religion that anchors hope in what you will do. Oh, but I can see more tangibly that I've ticked something off with that kind of religion. It's usually more socially acceptable, that kind of spirituality. It makes me feel better about myself. But any religion that is anchored in what I promise is dangerous territory. Not because rules are bad. They can be glorious, as God's law with Moses was. But faulty people can just never keep our end of the bargain. And actually, that sort of religion only really is a path to self-righteousness, as is any kind of system that puts faith in something in the air, making us better people. And the heart of the human problem remains the problem of the human heart. Well, as we finish, let's go on and look at the big and wonderful solution here. New and improved. Spot the language in verse 6 and 7. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it's enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion for a second. If the first iPhone had been faultless, there'd have been no occasion for the iPhone 2. And if the iPhone 2 had been faultless, there'd have been no occasion for the iPhone 3. And if the iPhone, we could go on, couldn't we? Where are we at? I think 12 is coming out soon. They've probably already designed number 13, but they have to spread it out so that you keep spending the money. Check out the new and improved covenant, verse 10. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Laws written into our minds. We're just often not good with laws and rules, are we? There's a lot of rules around. Go down to the underground. You know those stickers? There's rules everywhere, aren't there? And someone spotted there's so many stickers, they started to put up fake ones. And I bet you wouldn't have even noticed. Naughty passengers will be crushed. You know, that's the fake one. PCARS many tests that you let other people. Yeah, that, if you see that, don't worry. That is fake. And then finally, no eye contact penalty. Callum, when I showed him that earlier in the PA, he thought that was real. So there you go. It should be real, actually. It's very rude when people make eye contact with a fellow human being. But the point is, you can have stickers everywhere on the underground, and you can keep blaring instructions out of a tannoy system. But if people just don't love the rules, and that was the issue with the old covenant. Loads of laws, beautiful words about how to love God and neighbor. But in here, they didn't love God's law. The new covenant would be different. See, writing the laws on their hearts, that doesn't just mean swallowing a copy of Leviticus, learning it off by heart. It means internal surgery, heart surgery. That's why the new covenant is based on better promises. Because in the new covenant, God promises not just to bless his people if they will be faithful. He promises to change them inside so that we actually can be. In the Bible, the heart is way more than a muscle that pumps blood around the body. The heart and the mind are the center of who we are on the inside. They're where we feel and think and decide from. Verse 11. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. Back in Exodus, only Moses got to be near God. A few elders got to go partway up the mountain with him, and they caught a precious glimpse. But the rest of the people were nowhere near. Here is the promise of a spiritual revolution. They shall all know me, the ordinary people like us, from the least of them to the greatest. And God won't just change his people. He promises to change something in himself in verse 12. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sin no more. The wayward partner changed to become a faithful one. And the cheated on partner, who is deeply hurt, finds a way to unremember our sin. And isn't that the hardest thing when you've been wronged? I mean, we forget most things pretty quickly, actually, but we don't forget it when we've been wronged, when we've been cheated on. The divine capacity to unremember. Guys, this is a much more excellent arrangement. And guess what? The days of the new covenant described here have come. Do you remember Jesus' words? We read them as we celebrated communion last week. This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Now, we'll see in great detail next week just how Jesus' blood seals the deal. But pause and thank the Lord that this is describing our covenant relationship with God. Sin remembered no more. Peace with my Maker. No need to worry about what he thinks about me, whether he'll walk out on me. Total cleansing, my conscience clean. I have access to the throne room of heaven, not just for the few, but for the many. Heaven itself opened through the ministry of Jesus. And God's Spirit lives in me now, so that I, my deepest level, I long to know him and be like him and can begin to change. Isn't it great to be a Christian? Thank the Lord for the blessings of the new covenant that we enjoy right now. And yet, no matter how well the Christian life is going for you right now, friends, there's more than this. Sin still clings, doesn't it? And Hebrews has mainly actually been trying to point us to the future, to an inheritance that we haven't yet claimed. We have to be realistic. Verses 10 and 11 there are not yet fully realized. But I am excited about the day they will be, because I think that the full transformation in us is one of the most precious things about the world to come. Imagine not just always doing the right thing, but always wanting to. No more what would Jesus do, you know, WWJD, where's my bracelet? Because you'll know, because you know him and what he loves. And it can be so exhausting trying to have a relationship with God in a body like this that isn't fully aligned with him, isn't it? I can easily believe in the creative power of God to renew this physical universe, but making me into a fit person to be there, maybe that is the biggest miracle of all. No moral dilemmas anymore. No more deceiving ourselves into thinking that harmful stuff would be okay. No feeling distant from God or sluggish in the faith or hard in our hearts. This is the kind of hope that makes me say, come Lord Jesus. This is the great hope for humanity married to our Maker. So will you take God to be your husband? Will you love him, honor him, and forsaking all others, be faithful to him as long as you shall live? Believers want to say yes. But as a Christian in a still sinful body, beware of the grand gesture of commitment. All the things that the Lord has spoken we will do. Actually, the only thing you can be sure you will do this week is fail. Of course, faith leads to obedience. More about that in Hebrews, and we can talk more about that in the question time. But when you wake up tomorrow morning and you think about the state of your relationship with God, remind yourself who is the one in the relationship making all the promises.